Hello, friends and listeners of the Accents podcast on WUKY. I am Katerina Stoikova, the host, and this episode has been brought to you by Accents Publishing, an independent press for brilliant voices. Today's brilliant guest is poet, teacher, traveler, Joe Servant. Hi, Joe. Welcome to Accents.
Well, hello, Katerina. How are you doing?
I'm doing all right. You have a brand new book. The Stone was just published. How did this book come about?
Well, it's actually a long story. It started 40 years ago when I accepted a Fulbright fellowship to teach in Penang, Malaysia, and my family and I moved there for 13 months. And I wrote a lot while I was there because as the experience, there was so much new stuff around, so many new experiences that we hadn't had before, cultural differences. So it was pretty stimulating. But then when I got back, I noticed, I kept going back, and thinking about something, and I'd write another poem. And this went on, and I visited, I didn't get back to Penang for 30 years. This was after my wife's death. We had gone back together to Singapore a couple of times, but not made it into Malaysia. Gosh, I guess, the last poem that was written that's in the book probably is a bit, right before COVID. The last time I was in Asia was, I think, 2017, maybe 18, something like that. Part of it was published in Singapore in a small book. And the poems have just kept coming. As I have mentioned to a couple of people, I said it's kind of like mushrooms after a rain. They just sort of pop up. I don't know if I'll write any more about Asia or not, but finally, I think I've exercised it, maybe.
What did the readers in Singapore think of these poems?
They liked them. That's what gave me the encouragement I needed. Because I, you always feel a little hesitant as an outsider to a culture, writing about that culture. And, I would show them to colleagues at the university. And I actually did a little reading. And there were some few published in a little student publication at the university. And they seemed receptive. But the big thing, I think, was this first conference I went to in Singapore in 99, I believe. And I read two or three of the poems that are in the last section of this book, the Stone section, and particularly the title poem, The Stone. And afterwards, one of the women in the audience came up and she said, "Well, Joe, I didn't realize that you were a Buddhist." And I said, "Well, I'm really not." And she got a little miffed and she said, "Well, this is a Buddhist poem." So I thought, I took that as an affirmative that they would be accepted well. And then she suggested this small publisher for some of them there in Singapore. So that was how, really kind of the start of publication. Although, when I completely forget this. They're talking about 40 years. But when I first got back from Malaysia in the mid 80s, I worked on a smaller version of this, poems I'd basically written over there, and submitted them to the National Poetry, whatever that contest is, National Poetry Prize. And they came in as a finalist in that. But I couldn't find a publisher, for the whole bunch. So I've kind of put it aside and then just let these poems accumulate over the years till I reached a critical mass when I gave them to you.
We are very proud to have published The Stone from
Well,
Accents
thank you.
Publishing early this year. I don't know if The Stone is a Buddhist poem, but it certainly is a spiritual poem. Would you like to read it for us now?
Sure. The Stone. When you were born, tall, handsome woman with the slenderest of fingers gave you back your stone. She placed it on your tongue like an aspirin and held your mouth shut and stroked your throat until you had to swallow. The stone is smooth shaped and pressed by the weight of all the world's waters, rolled by the journeys of all the world's rivers to the sea. Inside you, it becomes a perfect sphere, the size of a pea. A thin layer of cells coats it so that you can carry it all your life like a shark carries souvenirs from all its meals. When you are ready to die, the woman will come again. She will still be handsome, and her fingers will still be sharp. With incredible ease and drawing very little blood, she will reach through your side and pluck out the stone, now big as a cherry. It has absorbed all your days and nights, which give it the color of pale blood. It is your stone, but she will keep it for you. When she swallows the stone, your heart will burst. When you are ready to try again, she will come to you. She will put the stone on your tongue and hold your mouth and stroke your throat. It will be harder to swallow. You will always wish for a smaller stone.
I think that's pretty amazing. It speaks to me, or my interpretation is how we accumulate our experiences and become bigger and bigger as personalities and as people, and reincarnation or not.
Right. We do accumulate, certainly, what we become. We become what we accumulate, let's put it that way.
It's true. But I don't wish for a smaller stone. I want to gather everything that I can while
All
I'm
right.
here.
Well, it might hurt to swallow it when you come back.
True. Talk about the organization of the book in three parts.
Well, I wanted to kind of give an introduction to country. And that's the first section. Jawhut orders the universe by color. And this is just this is the country as a whole. It does have an indigenous population called the Jawhuts. They live in the mountainous spine of Peninsular Malaysia, and so that they basically are encounters with. I actually did see run into these couple of or several teenage boys hunting with blowpipes. One of the poems in the book is about that. And just the wonder of that jungle and the ancient nature of it. I found in one that poem in Malay forests, I discovered after I wrote the poem and after the experience of going into the jungle for the first time that that's the oldest jungle in the world. It's 130 million years old. It just blew my mind. And of course, then it made it more tragic to see people cutting it down, just as they've done all over the world. I mean, it's not anything unique to Malaysia. So that was kind of that. I wanted that background of the jungle and nature. And then the second is I wanted to focus on the experiences we had there in Penang, on the where we lived. And that was very, very, right down the street was a Hindu temple where one day, one afternoon, kept hearing music and drums. And I thought, well, something's going on down at that little Hindu temple. And I walked down that, there's an alley behind their house. And I walked down the alley and they were doing a firewalking. And I'd never actually seen that, you know, I'd seen it on TV, but here they were doing it. I didn't write a poem about it, but that just illustrates the different things that we encountered there on that island without traveling any further. So that's what that section's all about. And then the stone, I think, is the more spiritual side, spiritual part of the book. You're around Muslims and you're around Hindus and you're around Buddhists. And of course, there's a Christian population too. But it's constantly being exposed to other religions. I think that by osmosis, that's what I told the woman in Singapore. I said, well, maybe by osmosis I'm a Buddhist because I was around so many Buddhists for over a year. But so that's basically the organization.
I would love to hear several poems, maybe a couple from each section if you would like to share.
Okay. Well, I'm going to read the poem that I like about the first time I went into the jungle. You know, when I mentioned that I found out how old it was. Of course, I thought I was going to into Eden. It was so lush and beautiful. And like Eden, it had snakes, which was a little worrisome because there were a lot of poisonous snakes there. In Malay forests, fear of snakes sends us high-stepping up the trail. Overhead, a tualong tree outstrips its rivals for air and light, despite the strangler fig growing from a crotch at 200 feet. All round, a silent life rises and falls beneath the airy bodies of leaves. Lianas, rattans, and creepers send dense signals where the slower self still reads the book of bramble and briar, and heartwood sap rises in tides where no moon shows, nor any hand leaf-like goes. And then the little coda that goes with that poem is called On Entering the Central Islands. Trees, a monotony of trees, where unnamed animals marked by light and dark wait patiently to lift the spell from men. So let's see, another one from that. Well, I'll read the poem about running into the boys hunting with blowpipes. We had taken a little break from the heat and humidity down the coast where we lived, went up into the mountains of central Malaysia, the peninsular Malaysia. And it was about 6,000 feet, I believe, 5 to 6,000 feet. So you got a big change in climate. And I was into jogging quite a bit back then. So it was real exhilarating to be able to run and to be cool. And so I got up early one morning, and the little place we were staying in had trails that led back into the forest behind it. And so I took my morning jog and I ran into these boys hunting. Their name for themselves is Orang Asli, which means something like first men or fresh people. All Aboriginal cultures refer to themselves as the first people. So, Orang Asli. Above Tanarata's little stones, the highlands rise and breathe the great forest and its great trees. Beneath those trees, I saw three boys hunting birds with blowpipes, wearing sneakers and jeans. Orang Asli, first men, caught in history's wash beyond the broad banana leaves. Surprise! I stopped and stared. They disappeared in the mountain's aching air. We kind of surprised each other. I was running, came around a curve, and there they were. They looked at me, and I looked at them. But the irony of it is they had on T-shirts from the United States. One of them had a Michael Jackson T-shirt
Oh,
on.
wow.
But they were hunting with blowpipes. We kind of stopped and looked at each other, and I wanted to handle one of the blowpipes. They were beautiful, and they were big, longer than I thought they would be. And but he kind of pulled back when I we didn't he didn't speak English, and of course I didn't speak his language either. But it was an interesting experience.
Perfect moment.
Yeah.
Perfect moment, and it's captured in a poem now.
Yeah. Let's see here. Well, I've talked about the destruction of the forest, and how upsetting that was. I mean, it's upsetting everywhere, but this was so pristine. I was just so overwhelmed by it. And there was another Fulbrighter on the in the Malaysian state, one of the Malaysian states on the island of Borneo, Sabah. And I went to visit him because the highest mountain, I believe, south of the equator, I'm not sure, but it's a high mountain called Mount Kinabalu. And he wanted to climb it. It's not a technical climb, but it's a big hike, 13,500 feet. And we had to spend the night going up. Then we came down one day. But being there and seeing all that, and then finding, there are places we'd drive along. Now, this is in Borneo, mind you, where they just clear cut the sides of hills. And of course, when the monsoons came, everything washed down across the roads, and people don't learn. There was something, the local government had something called the foundation, and they partnered with some Japanese lumber companies and with Weyerhaeuser in America. And one of the things that this guy wanted to show me, he was a botanist, was the largest flower in the world, the Rafflesia, which turns out is a parasite, which I did not know. So the title of the poem is "The Largest World's Largest Flower is a Parasite." Sabah Tower, tallest building on Borneo, rises from the deaths of a billion trees, flowers in the banks of Tokyo and Manhattan. Feeding on land and water, the tower grows, power beads like nectar along its stem. Weyerhaeuser, foundation, drip, drip on the forest floor. It sighs with vegetable sound as the great trees come down. Mirbal, Mirante, Balu, Bine, Bole, and Bower. In the foothills of Kinabalu, Rafflesia keeps a secret life. Vine within vine, waiting to efflorescence from dark buds and fragile soil. All the while, the silent tendrils take. The vine's blood becomes its own, their two hearts beating each to each. The monstrous flower, too late, the only sign.
Wow, what a statement about the way we live.
Yeah, that was depressing. There was just a nascent environmental movement when we were there, and the government didn't like it at all. And so anytime, somebody got too outspoken, they squashed them. Malaysia is supposedly a democracy, but it's been a one-party rule ever since the British left. And critics don't do well. I'll read the last poem in that section, which was written the second time I went back after my wife's death. Jungle Letter to My Wife, Virginie, 1944 through 2010. There was something I had wanted to say after the body's noise and fall, but the screen inside our ears was too deep to see, and now too late to tear away. The lives we lived and those we dreamed soared together, a strangler fig 200 feet above the jungle floor, whose slow aerial life brings down the greatest tree. In the noise and joy of all our hours, this terrible secret hummed unheard within you, a seed, some wayward bird dropped carelessly in the warm bark high up your body's tree. Okay. Moving over to Penang itself, Pulau Penang. The town on the little island is called Georgetown, but everybody referred to the, it's such a small island, everybody just said it's Penang. Or Pulau is the island. Penang, Pulau Penang would be Penang Island. And of course, you see the progress beginning there too. I mean, you can't really stop it. And there was only one building over four stories high when we lived there, and that was a shopping tower being built downtown. In fact, it was still being built, but they were still the bottom 10 floors, I think, or 8 floors were open for shops, small shops. They were beginning to build the first bridge to the mainland, and up to that point, you had to take a ferry or fly in. So once that bridge was built, then the development proceeded apace, and now they have two bridges. But at the time, they were building the first bridge, and right near the university. And so you step out of your office, and you could hear that pile driver going all the time, boom, 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 driving those pilings into the rock and the coral. The title is Pulau Penang Terus Maju. That means continuous progress for Penang Island, which is what the a slogan of all chamber of commerces around the world, continuous progress. The rhythm here is pile driver, the molar jarring ring of steel on steel to the percussion of steam, follows me from the pilings of the new bridge at Bayan Lepus to Jalan Sultan Ahmad Shah. They are never still. Days tick by to their beat. Traffic lunges forward with the same brutality. Earth and coral-headed rock give way slowly. The island winces under the blows, lurches sharply with the weight of high rise. Hemmed by mountains and sea, the rich go mad. They pound huge pillars into rock and blast the tops of hills, blowing forests into the sea. Displaced monkeys line the roads. Malaysia needs capital, the PM says. Bang, bang. Let the West feed the monkeys. Bang, bang. Land, timber, money. Bang, bang, bang. The steam-driven litany goes. And also go tigers, elephants, and great upland trees, Chinggal, Sereya, Mirbal, Meranti, bringing down in their tree deaths the lesser Larok and Teresina, fell to lie in ruin. In a shop on Chulia Street hang the dried penis and testicles of an ape. Mercedes queue up for potency after dark. No one believes anymore, but always the first law puts the hand before the life. And that is a quote from the Prime Minister. I didn't make that up. When people began to complain about the loss of wildlife with all the development, let the West feed the monkeys. And that was, he was quoted in the newspaper. We lived near a little area where there were a lot of eating stalls that people would come to at night. And the vendors would all drive up or ride up on motorcycles, set up their little kitchen areas and sell different kinds of food. And it was only, just about a block from our house. So very often that's where we ate supper. And I remember our daughters could get pancakes there or hamburgers, which they liked. The title is Navaratri, and that's a Tamil Hindu holy day celebrating the goddess Kakti, which is also no, who's also known as Kali, and it celebrates the triumph for good over evil. So that was going on, and at the same time we heard about these two women that had a noodle stand every night that we went to often being killed in an accident. So this poem is generated by the irony between the triumph of good over evil that's supposed to be taking place here and these two women. Navaratri. Today, the noodle woman and her sister were subtracted from the human sum. Their Honda 90 sent spinning across slick pavement like a stricken dog, their limbs adjusted permanently askew. The Bas Kilang had its own trajectory, the motorcycle less than vulnerable. The driver may have regretted, but the fine disharmony of thoughtless action is worked out in heat and motion. Billowing black smoke, dwarfing all else on the narrow streets, the buses are not to be taken lightly. And so, two cautious women are dead, while young boys on jazzed-up Suzukis slalom through tightly moving traffic in their own kamikaze versions of thrill. Kakti, why not them? But the inertia of the great diesel body simply cut down what was in its way, the slowest, the easiest, scattered upon the water like chum for rising sharks. 1,384 years ago, Mohammed journeyed from Mecca to Medina, and the year began. But Pearl Hill is silent in its mists. The island sways on its stem. Rain washes the streets each night and tells us that there is no struggle. The happy ending is that they were not killed. We heard that they died, but they were injured and were back another month selling noodles. So that was good. Oh, this is kind of interesting poem. As I say, we lived in a I mean, it was just a neighborhood, but it had a mixed population. There were Muslims, there were Buddhists, there were Americans, there were Englishmen, there were Australians, there were Hindus, It's all kind of a neighborhood. A lot of little craftsmen had up. You could do order anything, literally. My wife would take a picture out of a magazine. She brought a bunch of fashion magazines, and she'd take a picture and to some this woman, and she would make a dress, for her or for our daughters from the picture. And one of the interesting things about it, the Hindus in the little enclave they had down there, it was called a kampong. They still herded some cattle through the neighborhood, and they would go along the road or the alley, but they would eat off the grass along the margins. And this woman, this Hindu, Tamil, they were all the Hindus there are Tamil from Sri Lanka. This one woman came along every day about the same time, had about five cows, and she had a little switch, and she followed them around while they grazed, and that was her job. That's what she did all day. And of course, I thought about it. People had been doing that for 1,000 years. It hadn't changed at all. I couldn't find her. She didn't speak a word of English, and of course, I didn't speak Tamil, but we kind of became friendly. And I asked one of my colleagues at the university what you would call the woman who did that. And he gave me a Tamil word, idaiti. And I'm not sure that it means what he says it means. Loosely, it means a female cow herd. But anyway, so I kept wanting to take her picture, and she'd shake her head, no, 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 no. And then finally, one day, towards the end of her stay, I came out and I was just sort of watching her and watching the cows, and she kind of came up to me and made a motion like take a picture. And I couldn't tell any difference. Why did she want a picture now? But she had her best piece of material kind of draped over her shoulder. Now, I've got the picture. It's a great picture. Idaiti, where rubber and rambutan once flourished, she keeps her own paths through Tanjanabunga. The only grass now borders on asphalt and concrete, but still the cycle goes. The habit of 3,000 years ignores houses sprouting like fungi, the traffic hurtling into confusion along the coast. The cattle do not hurry. She prods them only when the grass is gone. Still, my daughters wait. They like the gentleness of cattle raised in towns. There is the sway of brown haunches, the velvet skin, and my girls who offer leftovers and plates to great soft lips and tongues. The cattle are polite, but the old Tamil woman eyes us, beef eaters. She knows the calm of cattle living with women beyond the knives of men. Around the bovine flesh, my daughters celebrate the lifting of the curse which once could bind them, skin and hair, to the hides of cows. The soft flanks give way before the girl's excited dance. The wand is raised and the cows pass on. They were fascinated with those cows. They were only 3 and 8 and 9 at the time.
Well, I'm going to interject with a question now, and
Okay.
it's, what does your family, what do your daughters say about these poems?
My youngest daughter was only 2 and a half. And so I think basically she has memories, but they're basically most of what she remembers is from us telling her and looking at pictures. Now, the older daughter was in third grade there. And so they like the memory quality of this book. A lot of the things they saw and did. They didn't get to go in the jungle with me, but just about everything else they did. Or to Borneo, I went by myself to Borneo. But yeah, they've enjoyed it.
Did living abroad make them more adventurous
Oh
eaters?
yeah, oh yeah. It's like a virus. Once you start traveling, and I mean, it was a different world, Katarina. I mean, we got on transcontinental airplane in Seattle and flew to Hawaii for the first leg and then to Hong Kong and then on into Tokyo and then Hong Kong and then into to Penang. But you could get on the airplane then and there'd be empty seats. And they'd just look around and try to find seats that they wanted to sit in so they could sit away from their parents. And they could lay a pallet on the floor, take a nap. This was a totally different experience. But we traveled quite a bit. We decided to live cheaply, live well within our budget so that we could travel more. And while we lived there, we went to the Philippines, we went to Thailand, and we went to Singapore, we went to Hong Kong. And at that time, China had only been open to Westerners for about 4 or 5 years. And we actually got into China in 1983. And that was very interesting, very different from the last time I went to China, 6 years ago. And then on the way home, I managed to talk to the Fulbright Committee into giving me the money for the plane fare. And a colleague helped me find a cheap way to get home on a branch of Air France. And we took over a month to get back to Kentucky. So we hopscotched through the South Pacific. And that was amazing. That was the experience that I know my oldest daughter hadn't forgotten it. And they love to travel. You give them a chance, say I'm ready. Money and time are the only limitations.
Please continue your reading.
Okay.
Would love to hear
Okay.
more poems.
I'll read the poem that I wrote the first time I got back to Malaysia after my wife's death. L little hard to read, but sometimes it's necessary to read it. Penang, 30 years later. Our old house in Penang is now abandoned, wearing down under the soft lick of sun and water, its cool tile floors defaced by the mindless graffiti of rats, mold smudged black fingerprints on all the walls and doors. Alive again, you stand on the balcony in the modest shorts and polo shirt that scandalized the neighbors a quarter century ago. You watch as I wash our old Cortina and spray our daughters who circle giggling in their batik bikinis. We are full of our lives in the exotic. We see only the left side of our parenthesis. Yeah, I remember that was pretty hard to go back to that old house where we lived and to see it abandoned like that. I think the people that owned it, they were waiting for somebody to buy them out. There was so much development going on that people were getting high prices for selling the land that their old homes were on.
It must have been difficult to go back.
I really regret the 2 times we were in Singapore that we didn't go on up to Penang. It wasn't that far, but we were always on a schedule, always had to be back at a certain time, mainly because we didn't take kids with us. And so that was a made it necessary to make a quick trip. I'm going to read a poem from the last section in the Snake Temple. Before we went, I had some Malaysian women in my graduate novel class at Western. And when they found out I was considering a Fulbright to Malaysia, that turned out they were from Penang, from this little island where we ended up. And they started bringing me all these tourist brochures, bringing everything, oh, this is so great. Look at this. And one of the brochures that they hand me is called Penang for the Visitor. And one of the most interesting things in it, I had it for years. I might still have it somewhere, but it was called a little essay about the Snake Temple. And it's a Buddhist temple, and they're actually poisonous wa wagglers, pit vipers all around the altar in the temple. And it was, of course, a big tourist attraction because of that. So this is the first time I visited the Snake Temple once we got there. In the Snake Temple. And there you will find snakes coiling around the altar as if intoxicated by the smell of burning incense. Penang for the visitor. And I think that's probably true. They were somewhat intoxicated because they're very lethargic. Until the joss stick moved, I had thought Snake Temple was metaphor, like the temple of God. But before me, a waggler's viper translated itself from stone to flesh. Monks moved carelessly among the miracles, still figures of speech to their bare heels, while all about the hieroglyphs of stone scripture undid themselves. Then I heard the secret epiphanies of snakes whispered in the room, and like my brothers, those exegetes of Mark in the hills of East Tennessee was racked by the rhythm of tongues. Of course, that first thing when I read about the snake temple and the poisonous snakes, I thought about people in Appalachia, particularly East Tennessee and East Kentucky, handling poisonous snakes. So I had to write that poem.
And of course, the poem is in the spiritual section of the book.
Yeah, this is the stone. All these are poems on the stone. The next one is called Samadhi. Samadhi is just the point of deepest meditation. If you're a Buddhist meditator, and some people say it's when you reach that, you reach enlightenment. Samadhi. Find the deep pool, the one where the river has eaten the meal of limestone and left behind the bones of a bluff lying calmly in the water like languorous buffalo. Become a glowing red carp living in a deep, still pool. Hang suspended in the place where it is neither dark nor light. Then move faster than the dragonfly that caught kisses the face of the pool at noon. When you find that pool and become that carp, move neither against the stream where the rapids rattle their stones, nor go with it where the current dies and the banks flatten and the water's mouth is filled with mud. Make no bargains, make no trades. The pool is a stone tossed to earth from a great height. You are the jewel that glistens when the geode cracks. My yoga teacher likes that one in particular. One of the my visits back, I have a place to stay. Another Fulbrighter there was from the University of Montana, and he ended up marrying a Malaysian woman from not from Penang. She's from East Malaysia, and so when they when he retired from Montana, they bought a little retirement place in Eugene, Oregon, where he had grown up. And they also bought a condominium in Malaysia. So they live half a year in Oregon and half a year in Malaysia. So I always go stay with them. And they live on the 20th floor, I believe, looking down into the Strait of Malacca or the Sea of Andaman Sea. And so my favorite thing to do was to sit up on that balcony early in the morning, drink my coffee, and of course, if I thought of anything, scribble it down. So one day, I was just thinking about I don't know, the sea and the creative nature of the ocean, the fact that we all came from the ocean. And I thought about the Hindu creation story, where Vishnu creates the world out of a sea of milk. So it's my version of it, creation story. To clear a spot in chaos for creation, Vishnu ladled all the demons out of the churning sea of milk that would become the universe, but not before they fouled it. So he created fish to eat their excrement and clean the sea. For a while, the milk was good again, but then he made people who invented nets and caught all the fish and fried them up. Undigested, the demons' feces got into their cells and drove them mad so that they began to beat and tear each other. Vishnu put his head in all four hands. He'd have to think of something else.
What is the connection between writing and connection with higher power?
Well, this is not something that I've thought of, but we had a poet from Chicago, Lee Young Lee, come and read. Well, this is years ago when he was just starting out. I think his first book had been published. And he and I were talking and about writing. And what where it comes from, writing poetry. And he said his idea was that it came from prayer. It was the same thing as prayer. And I had thought about that, and I think you do get into a state where things fall away around you, but that opens up what's already there in you. I don't know whether it's a, something being given to you from the outside, or whether it's just welling up to the surface in your mind when you get into that state. Like the poem, The Stone, it was written one sitting. No, I never changed a word. It just came out. And you think, well, where did that come from? If I were Greek, ancient Greek, I'd say the Muses gave it to me. If I were, well, John Keats, I'd say La Belle Dame gave that to me. She takes the night under the hill. And then Robert Duncan's poem, Often I'm Permitted to Return to a Meadow, which I take as a poem about that creative force, which is mysterious. So I think there is a connection. It may be just the state of mind that you write, that I sometimes write poetry in. My best poetry, I think, is written in that state, which is kind of like a state of prayer, as Lee Young said. But other than that, I don't know if I could be any more precise.
No, that's plenty precise. I mean, if it were a mathematical thing, people would have solved that equation long ago. Please continue with your reading.
This one is called Maya, and it's from Hinduism. It's Maya is the illusory nature of the world. I take it as what a little I know about it, not, which is not a lot, that it's similar to Plato's analogy of the cave, that this the world we see through our senses and experience through our senses is not the full world, that there's some larger reality behind it. So this is my version of that, Maya. The cattle stand facing east. Their bodies shine like lumps of coal in the rising sun. They stand in the center of the worn geometry of their path. Sun warms their backs, making light upon them tremble. Hard hooves have vanished. Around them, the yellow heads of dandelions collapse and rid themselves of ragged bodies rising from milky roots. Nearby, the tight brown coats of cattails, emphatic on the margins of the pond, have begun to dissolve into flakes of airborne down. I am here watching, wearing my heaviness like a coat. Hard matter in its home around me seems poised to disappear. One thing it just occurred to me, and when I read that, wearing my heaviness like a coat, I think there's a little bit of echo in here of Walden, Thoreau's Walden, which is suffused with what we might say is Eastern philosophy as well as Western. We know he had a copy, he borrowed Emerson's copy of the Bhagavad Gita, so we know he read that. And you sense that in a lot of his writings there. Of course, Whitman, for sure. But that idea that matter around us is not really as hard as we think it is, and it can disappear. That fascinated me.
What an amazing book. What an amazing set of poems about experiences in different places with different cultures, with open heart and open eyes. And how is travel the gift that keeps on giving?
That's I think I feel sorry for people that never really travel much, at least don't get away from their own culture. We just become tunnel have a tunnel vision, I think, for that reason.
People can travel by reading books also, by
Oh, of course.
experiencing art and watching movies. You served as a poet laureate of Kentucky about 20 years ago. What was your experience and how would it be different if it was now?
Oh, I think it'd be much busier. People seem to be on the go more. It was still kind of a new thing. I remember when James Becker Hall, he was before me, we read together at Murray as he was out, going out, and I was coming in as poet laureate. And he was telling me, he said, "Well, Joe, now the poet laureate position is starting to gain some traction. So you'll probably be busier than I was." And then, of course, each succeeding poet laureate got busier and busier. So I think it would have been a different experience. It was a little more laid back and easygoing when I was poet laureate. I did travel all over the state and then to West Virginia a couple times, so Indiana. So that was in Cincinnati. That was fun. But it was a slower paced job back then.
Jane Gentry, who was also a poet laureate, I interviewed her during at the end of her tenure, and she said that she had a map of Kentucky and she had a goal to visit every one of the counties. I don't know if she
Oh
was
my
able
God.
to. Yeah.
Did she do it?
I
She
can't
did say that.
remember, but that was her goal.
Yeah. Wow. Well, Jane was a good friend of mine. In fact, we dated for a while, and I remember when I walked into her front door one day and she told me and said, "Oh, Joe, I've got bad news. I've got the same cancer that your wife died of." She said, "But I'm not gonna die." And I said, "Okay. That's good." But yeah, I miss her. She was a good person and a good poet.
And very, very gentle lady.
Yes, she was. She was very that's a good word for her. She was a gentlewoman.
Are you writing new poems?
Yeah, I'm still writing. I'm just not as dedicated as I should be with being retired, but I do write, and I realize, when I'm trying to put together another book that I've got a lot of stuff that I've hadn't looked at in years. And that's kind of fun, but maybe I've gotten one or two in the last 3 or 4 weeks that I, feel like I want to keep and can work with. So.
You've been teaching most of your career, if not all
Right.
your career.
Yep.
So there is a question that I ask all my guests who teach creative writing, and that is, what is the most important thing you teach your students? If there is one thing that you want them to remember from your class or workshop, what is it?
Well, see, I'm a little bit different because I didn't do any creative writing. I don't come out of a creative writing background. Mine's a traditional PhD in literature. And when we started the creative writing program at Western, a colleague of mine was teaching poetry writing. And I was real content to continue teaching lit. But every once in a while, I would teach poetry writing when he wasn't available, and then when he retired. But I'm not like other people that did the MFA and taught creative writing. My bulk of my career was teaching literature. But I do remember the thing I always tried to emphasize to the kids in the creative writing classes: you can't r write if you don't read. And too many of them just want to have written. They want to whatever they've done, and that be it. And didn't want to what revise, which is such a crucial part. And reading and revision, read widely. Don't just read poetry, read everything. Everything's grist for the mill.
Thank you, Joe. I appreciate you coming on Accents and giving us so much from yourself and reading so many wonderful poems. Best of luck with reading and writing from this point
No.
on.
All right. Thank you, Katerina. Thanks for having me.